City at a time. This is NPR.
Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
Hill House, not sane, stood by itself against its hills, holding darkness within. It had stood so for 80 years and might stand for 80 more. Within walls continued upright, bricks met neatly, floors were firm, and doors were sensibly shut. Silence lay steadily against the wood and stone of Hill House, and whatever walked there walked alone. Welcome to the Halloween edition of Delmarva Today, the writer's edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The reading you just heard is the opening paragraph of The Haunting of Hill House by Shirley Jackson. It's a classic horror story of ghosts and things that go bump in the night that ambiguously leads us to wonder if the ghosts in Hill House are supposed to be real or a creation of the deranged mind of one of its inhabitants. Author Shirley Jackson says the ghosts are real. But then, this is fiction, isn't it? Today we inaugurate the new one-hour time frame for the writer's edition of Delmarva Today. In our first segment, we're going to talk about real haunted houses on the Delmarva Peninsula with Mindy Burgoyne, the author of Haunted Eastern Shore and the leader of Ghost Walks on the Delmarva. In our second segment, we'll present a radio drama of another great classic horror story, The Monkey's Paw, by British author W.W. Jacobs. Mindy, welcome to the writer's edition of Delmarva Today.
Thank you, Hal. I'm pleased to be here.
In Jackson's The Haunting of Hill House, the narrator tells us that Hill House is an evil house. Are there any houses in your book that you would describe as evil, or any houses on your ghost walk that you think might be evil?
I don't think so. I don't look at houses or presences in these houses or buildings as evil or good. I think that there can be negative energy. You know, we're all spiritual beings. Everything is charged with energy. Every living thing is charged with energy. But sometimes the human emotion can make an imprint on the energy. If you have a place where there's a big battle like Gettysburg and there's terrible carnage, that can leave that imprint of energy that is what it is. It's very tragic. And I think that can happen in houses. But I think the evil piece is kind of hyped up in literature for entertainment. There can certainly be a negative energy. And I think the negative energy can be changed. I think it doesn't always have to be that way, but certainly there are houses. The Snow Hill Inn would be a good example of a building that has been probably plagued with negative energy for a long time, but I wouldn't call that evil.
Holly Hill, in your book, for example, is a cursed house. Now, does a cursed house become evil, or does a cursed house just become imbued with negative energy?
That's what a curse is. A curse is from your own, the core of your own spiritual energy. You impart negativity to something else. And I've read a lot about curses, actually, and they're kind of fascinating to me. But the old saying about curses always seems to ring true. If you curse something that is it warrants the curse, you know, that's done something evil to you or done something awful to you, then the curse stays. But if that entity you curse you curse in error, the curse comes back to you, which I think is what happened in certainly in Holly Hall. So, yeah, there's a definite, you know, if you go visit Holly Hall, stand in the presence of Holly Hall, which you can today, you can feel that negative energy around it. It's a very, very sad place.
Yeah. How did you first become interested in haunted places, the haunted places that you write about? And what led you to write this book?
Probably a combination of things. I've been writing a long time about mystical places. Places in Ireland mostly, and I traveled there and worked. I've written a lot about places where the veil between this world and the eternal world is thin. So I had that on my mind, but when I moved to the Eastern Shore 11 years ago, I moved into a house where lots of strange things happened, and they were not fascinating. They were disturbing. So that got the whole haunted element on my mind. You know, what's happening here, these manifestations of a weirdness. You know, when you don't believe in ghosts, or I don't know that I didn't believe in ghosts. I just knew that I certainly the whole thing was new to me. But the unexplained events in my home, as well as my interest in these thin places, I think are what led me to write this little book.
Thin places. Say something else about thin places, if you would.
Well, The concept of thin places I certainly didn't define. It really comes out of the old Celtic tradition. Halloween was started in Ireland. I mean, we know that. We know that the people of the pre-Christian Celts, pre-Christian Irish, let's say, believed that there was a world under their feet, an underworld, and there was a world above, which would have been what we consider heaven. And then there was the present world. So there were these three worlds. And the underworld was a very daunting population. They didn't quite understand it. They were afraid of it. But on one day a year, on Samhain, which was October 31st, portals opened between the underworld and this world. And that was the time when these underworld people could pass into our world. And they were frightened. So they would dress in costume to scare them away. And even today in Ireland, especially in the north, people don't go out. It's not like they celebrate it. They're sensitive to that tradition. They'll all tell you they don't believe that nonsense, but they stay home. So the concept of thin places is places where the eternal world or the spiritual world, which you have to believe in to even take on the concept of thin places, is right in our midst. It's not far away. It's the same. It's just a different dimension. And there are some places where the veil that separates the two worlds is sort of porous. One world bleeds into the next. That's why we see spirits or we hear things or we experience a strong, overwhelming sense of something.
Are those stories perhaps the source of the famous musical Brigadoon? I think that might be Scotland, but I'm not
sure.
It's
the same tradition.
And it's the same.
Yeah,
it comes out of that tradition where this village appears every 100 years as real and people can enter into it.
It's the same concept. And that Western European, you know, with the UK and Ireland and Brittany and maybe Northern Spain, you know, they were all, I believe they're all sort of on this vortex where there are porous places. I mean, certainly sacred sites exist everywhere in the world, but this tradition has existed in that place. And these stories that come out of it have existed in Western Europe for a very long time.
When you do your tours in Ireland, for instance, do you visit haunted houses as well, or is that a different kind of tour?
Actually, next year's tour, which is in September, we're doing haunted castles. We're doing Charleville and Lepp, which are two very, very, they're associated with hauntings. So that, it's the same concept, whether it's stone circles that have a portal into, you know, the eternal world, or they're a castle where you see the apparition of a child running up and down the steps that, you know, the child lived hundreds of years ago. It's really the same story.
We're going to talk in a minute about apparitions and things that go bump in the night in this country. But just one more kind of general question for you in that vein is when an apparition, in your mind anyway, when an apparition is sighted, is the apparition coming into our world through that thinness, or is the person visualizing the apparition moving into another dimension or another world?
Well, there are 100 answers to that question because there are many conflicting beliefs.
We may have time for one.
I only have my answer to that question.
Well, okay, what's your answer?
But when I say this, there'll be people in the listening audience going, "That is not true."
Okay.
Because this is where we all argue. But this is what I think. I think that world exists, and it exists in spite of us. It doesn't exist because of us. It is there, the eternal world. And I think that it is the person in this world that senses these things using psychic abilities. You know, we don't use all of our brain. And so our brain can sometimes be exercised in certain ways where some people have a greater ability to see into that world. That world's there, whether you see it or not. So some people are more clairsentient. You know, they sense things. They might smell something. You know, the Trimper's Carousel, that's people smell the perfume around that in Ocean City. Or some people might be clairvoyant, where they see apparitions, shadows, or people, and some might be clairaudient. They hear noises. They hear voices. But that's just our capability. So when you visit psychics or mediums, all those people are people that have exercised that capability. And I think whether you take a picture that gets something in it, or whether you see a vision of someone coming down the stairs who is not part of our world, that's your ability to see that. It's your ability to take that picture. So I don't think it's a remnant of an old memory the way the paranormal investigators tend to believe. I think it's the person's ability to connect with the other world, the degree of psychic capability they have.
Or if you believe in those things, the ability of the other world to communicate with our world. I have a very good friend in Norfolk, Virginia, who insists that her house is haunted. And you make me think of it when you mention the different ways apparitions appear, because for her, the apparition appears as an odor, a very defined odor. And sulfuric kind of odor, but it is contained. You can walk into it and out of it, and it is just there. And it appears every now and then. They have named her Mrs. Robinson. And it's interesting that Mrs. Robinson appears whenever anything new happens in the house, or when they've been gone for a long period of time and they come back. Mrs. Robinson will literally come down the stairs and greet them at the door. And they bought a gerbil for their daughter, and Mrs. Robinson came in the room upstairs to see the gerbil. And my friend was sitting at her computer one day, and Mrs. Robinson was watching her work over her shoulder. And she turned and said, "Ms. Robinson, you're freaking me out. Go away." And Mrs. Robinson immediately, no lingering, no nothing, immediately was gone. Well, let's shift gears for just a minute. And I noted that there's a significant amount of research evidenced in your book. How did you go about identifying these haunted places? And tell us a little bit about the enormous amount of organizational work you did to lay out the histories of all of these places.
Well, I started with the NAB Research Center at Salisbury University. They're, you know, very fortunate to have this collection of folklore. There was a college instructor that taught folklore, and she sent her students out to take commentary from informants across the shore about lots of things, and not just the hauntings, about how to make jam, how they slaughtered hogs, how they celebrated Christmas. But there are hundreds and hundreds of pages about hauntings. And so every night after work, I would go up, you know, when they were open, and sort through taking out the pieces that had to do with hauntings, and I photocopied them because I have a day job, so I can't do the research in the NAB Center. But I spent months at home sorting them out by county in Maryland. I decided to limit it that way, so I covered the 9 Eastern Shore counties, which would be Cecil, Kent, Queen Anne, Dorchester, Talbot, Caroline, Worcester, Wicomico, Somerset, and tried to even it up so that I had some from every county. And I made some selections like Holly Hall. I have a whole folder just of Holly Hall. There was so much commentary on Holly Hall, the Cellar House. There was a little on the Snow Hill Inn. And I knew Old Bohemia had a bunch. So I chose based on what I thought would fit 3 criteria. And one was that, it was an interesting tale. There was something going on there now. And B, it had to have a history I could identify, you know, because I think the thing that makes haunting so fun is knowing who it might be. That's the entertainment piece. Because actually, hauntings are all the same story. If I just told you what happened in a house, it would be I saw someone in the stairway. I heard someone call my name. I heard a crash. No one was there. It's always the same. It's always the same manifestation. Sometimes it's a little different. But the history piece is important. And then the last piece would be that someone – I would have to get some kind of experience today. Someone would have to say this happened now. And I tried to also – keep a fair mix of public places. So if people wanted to take this book and actually go, they could go to White Marsh Cemetery, they can go to Holly Hall, they can drive past the Snow Hill Inn. So that's how I started. And I identified, I think, 26 or 27, and maybe I identified 30. And then as we went through editing, we had to cut back. But the research started at Salisbury University. And then I have a huge library at home of books on Maryland history and Eastern Shore history, and I used them, and I did a lot of personal interviews.
Well, one of the stories that you tell, and one of the places you look at is the Old Bohemia Church. Would you read a portion out of your book?
Sure, I would. I probably should preface it by saying what Old Bohemia Church is, because
no
idea.
Oh, yes, please.
Old Bohemia is in Cecil County, sort of on the Cecil-Kent border on the Bohemian River. And back in the early 18th century, when the first Catholic settlement came to Maryland, and people may not realize Catholics were really persecuted here. And there was only one mission church in St. Mary's County. And they knew that they could not educate new priests there because there was so much oppression. There were a lot of people there, and it was too much in the public eye. So one of the priests from there sent a Father Mansell out into the wilderness, which ended up being this place in Cecil County on the Bohemia River, and said, you need to start a mission there, and eventually we need to build a seminary there so we can educate priests so we can grow this religion. And Father Mansell did go out there, and he ended up building a church. The church, I think, was built in 1740, and the frame of that is still there. And then eventually, it took 40 years for them to build that seminary. But John Carroll went to the seminary, so he was the first Catholic bishop. He modeled Georgetown Seminary after the Old Bohemia Seminary. And his brother Charles Carroll, who was the signer of the Declaration of Independence, Charles Carroll of Carrollton in Howard County, also attended. So it had a great influence. That seminary is all gone. But the old church is there, and behind the church in this overgrown boxwood covered sort of plot are the 10 first Jesuit priests that saw it through. So I heard that it was haunted, and I went up there and just hung around and decided that this was very worthy. During my research on Old Bohemia, I conducted interviews with people from the Old Bohemia Historical Society and those who have connections with the church. All agreed that there was a presence there. There were several accounts of people hearing doors open, footsteps walking the halls, and boots clomping up and down the stairs in the old priest's living quarters. One person told of a book mysteriously appearing in one of the priest's bedrooms and eyeglasses relocating themselves. Workers hired to do renovations complained about being able to hear voices, especially in the sacristy, but no one was there. And another volunteer stated that she was alone in the church. She knew she was the only one on that isolated property, but she heard voices in the sacristy. She approached the closed door and could clearly hear people behind the door whispering, but when she opened the door, no one was there. All agree, however, that the presence is peaceful and benevolent. Old Bohemia is a happy place. Standing at the south side of the church, looking across the cemetery, one gets a splendid view of the upper shore landscape. The property is surrounded by rolling farmland. I stood there at dusk when I visited and had an overwhelming sense of being able to feel all that had happened there in just a few short moments. There's a deep faith and peace at Old Bohemia. Above the entrance to St. Francis Xavier Church at Old Bohemia, the following words are inscribed. Indeed, the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. There is no other but the house of God and the gate of heaven here.
So it's interesting that that you note that Old Bohemia Church is a peaceful place in spite of the things that go knock all during the day and night, not just at night. In your research and your work, have you ever found an account of a ghost that actually visited physical harm on anyone?
Never.
Never. Yeah.
I never have, and I don't think spirits are equipped to do that.
Yeah. What happens in fictional accounts and novels and stories is generally the same thing, and it's often the people in their guilt and in their fright who visit disaster on themselves, which I think is really very interesting. Your book and your ghost walks, I understand, are very, very popular. To what do you account this popularity? And we have all these ghouls and goblin movies that people flock to and everything. Why do you think ghosts and the paranormal and the supernatural are so popular today?
I think people are really looking, people are really searching for that awakening. We're living in a time where social media lets you see what's happening in all around the world. It's harder to hide. It's harder for oppressive type regimes, whether they're a government or even a religion. In some cases, religion can be very oppressive. People can talk about it. They can be more open about it. And so they're really searching, and they're looking at their faith, and that could be growing stronger, or they could be looking for more. But all of these attempts, whether it's vampires and ghouls or it's angels and apparitions, it's all this yearning to see what's on the other side and connect with it. I think we're at a time where that's very, very powerful. So, I'd love to say I'm such a great writer and that this book, this book is in its sixth printing. It sold probably over 10,000 copies in a region that should not buy that many.
Listen, I've read it and I read it carefully, and I think that it's an excellent book.
Well, thank you. But it's also a great niche, as are the ghost walks. And because people are interested in that, and I think they're more seriously interested. There are some people that want to go and they want to get scared. Now, I was in Pocomoke, and I always go to the police station and the town hall. I make sure that if I need any permits, I have them. And then I let the police know I'm walking around with 20 people in the dark through their graveyards. And, and when I went to Pocomoke, the police were so receptive. They were so supportive because they had a haunted jail. And one of them said, listen, when you go in the forest, if you want, we can hide, at the entrance and then just scare them to death when they come out. We could do that. I said, that's really not way
well,
my
that's
ghost
not really
walks
the
works.
Idea here. Yeah.
Not my ghost
but
walk
thank
style.
You.
But I think that's why they're popular, because people want to know the history and they want to know what's there now.
What would you say is the most popular story in your book that you've gotten the most response to, and in your ghost walks as well? Is there one that people
there are three.
Particularly like?
There are three, and now there's a fourth one emerging. But certainly Big Liz is it.
Say again?
Big Liz in Dorchester County is an old traditional tale.
Okay.
Everyone's heard it, and people never get tired of hearing it. And then Wish Shepherd at the Denton Jail. That's... if you took Wish Shepherd, Big Liz, and Snow Hill Inn, they would probably be the most well-known popular stories.
You're going to have to tell us those stories very
quickly. Well, just real quick. Big Liz was an African slave. I mean, she was American, but she evidently was very big. And the traditional tale, the African-American community has one tale, and then the white community has another tale, which is, so I tried to merge them both. It's likely that we didn't have any battles here on the shore during the Civil War, but a lot of the money is suspected to have been kept here on the farms because there was a great Confederate sympathy, because we did have slaves, you know, all over the plantations on the shore. And there was the African American slaves would had their own way of resisting, in that they would leak information to the Union Army informants to say where this money was moving. And it's likely, and this is, comes from the African American tradition, that Big Liz wasn't just a big dumb slave that, you know, when her master said, "Come here and help me bury the treasure," and then he cuts off her head. She probably informed somebody that he was moving his money, because he had to move it again. And to make an example of her, he said, "Well, come on, Liz, let's go rebury my money," because you didn't go to the bank in those days. You had gold and you buried it. And so she went with him, and he made her dig the hole. They put the treasure in it. And he said, "Well, let's put this sapling on top of it so I'll remember where it is." And as she reached for that, he whacked off her head. And so this was evidently near Greenbrier Swamp. So today they say if you go over to Courcy Bridge late at night, and I think there is a tradition of honking your horn a number of times and flashing your lights, Big Liz will come out of the swamp with her head in her hands and motion you to come, and she'll show you where that treasure is. But if you follow her, you'll probably never come out. No one ever has. And so people go down on that bridge and do that. But I know adults that I like and respect that say they've, you know, actually seen her. And of course, then the other one at Snow Hill Inn is the idolat boy who committed suicide, allegedly committed suicide, and he haunts that place. Mm. And Wish Shepherd was an African-American convicted criminal who was being hanged for assaulting a white girl back in 1905, I think, right, 1915. And he is said to have gripped the wall as he left, and his handprint stayed on the wall forever. It's still there, and that he haunts the jail. So these are public places. Well, Snow Hill Inn isn't a public place, but you can walk in front of it and stand there for a few minutes, which I do with the ghost walks. And I just say, just stand here and be quiet. Eventually, that negative energy is just going to fall on you. You'll feel it.
And if you go in that cell today, do you see that hand?
The cell has been covered up. The cell has been, they just built, they closed it off and built around it during the expansion. But the handprint was there. I know somebody that, you know, grew up in the house because he was the sheriff's son. He was then later the warden. And he said he saw the handprint. His father tried to cover it with concrete, tried to paint over it, and it always came back.
And Snow Hill, you said there were three?
And Snow Hill is, yeah. I mean, Snow Hill has a huge presence about it. And everybody that's been in there has, you know, there's one thing when you have one haunted story. It's another thing when you have a series of owners, a series of occupants and workers and visitors that all that are unrelated, that have stories. And that would be the, which have the Snow Hill Inn. I think the Snow Hill Inn is more like a place where there's probably a vortex, you know, kind of a thin place, a place where it's easy to, you know, to have one side bleed into the other side.
Even without the ghost stories and the paranormal accounts, your history of the various places mentioned in the book are fascinating. It's almost as though the ghost stories is an overlay, a bonus on that. Did you visit all of these places
that you
write about?
I absolutely had to. I wouldn't have been able to write about them if I didn't. I mean, except Cosden Murder Farm. Obviously, that's not there anymore, but I did go to the site.
I wanted to ask you about the woman who's whose skull
Patty Cannon
you had in your you held Patty in your
Cannon.
Hand. Tell us about her.
Patty Cannon, well, we don't know anything really accurate about Patty Cannon, except she died in the Georgetown jail. There's very, and she had a lot of crimes pending against her. There was a lot of court cases, non-payment, you know, debt, stealing, But they could never arrest her because her property was on three counties. So, if you know, she'd have people tip her up. If the Dorchester people were coming, she'd run over to the Caroline side. And if the Sussex people were coming, she'd run to the Dorchester side. But they finally found – they suspected that she kidnapped African-Americans that were free and then would sell them down the river, which is where that actually – that phrase came from. She would hold them and then get them on a ferry, send them down to the South and collect money. Sometimes she would steal slaves, and if she had only stuck to free people, the free African Americans had no voice, so she probably could have gotten away with a lot more. But it's said that she was a ringleader of a gang. Now, there are historians that dispute that and say that it was really her son-in-law. So there's really no history. So I went with what I was going to go with. This is the tradition that she died in 1825. So this was well before the Civil War. But she was a kidnapper and a murderer. And finally, a farmer next to her farm, which is up there. Like I said, it's right between – it's in Reliance and El Dorado, that area. Found bones when he's plowing and told the police. And then they got one of her – she had a slave boy that she kept with her. And the law enforcement got him and said and threatened him to tell to tell on her. And he told her where the other bodies were buried, and they dug them up. And all three jurisdictions got together and said, let's all go at once. And they decided to let Delaware have her. She was old by the time – I mean, I think she was in her 60s. Or 70s, and in 1825, that was old, and they decided to let Sussex have her, and so they took her to the Georgetown jail, and she died in jail. So some people think that I've heard that people say she had cyanide sewed in the hem of her dress, which I think was unlikely. The tradition is she committed suicide. It wouldn't surprise me if she didn't commit suicide. But they buried her in a pauper's grave with two other people. And then they had to put a parking lot in there years later. And so they knew who they were. They were exhuming because they had to relocate those graves. And one of the deputies said, can I have the skull of Patty Cannon? So he got it. And his relatives left it to the Dover Library because that was his favorite place. And Dover Library had it. And I went out there and saw it and took the pictures. And it's now in the Smithsonian, so you can't do that anymore.
Well, in the few minutes that we have left, Mindy. You say in your book that your own house is haunted. Tell us about your house, and tell us about your experience in your haunted house.
Well, I just had as part of the Ghost Walks a visit to my house. We had 50 people in two groups, and taking their pictures and doing their paranormal stuff. And my house is a Victorian house built by the Miles family in Marion Station, and it has lots of weird things happen. And it, you know, we've heard voices, we've seen my children have been pushed down the steps, lights go on and off, and it happened for several years. It disturbed us so much that we put our house for sale, and then when we had somebody come and look at the house, she talked to someone in the attic. So, at any rate, I had a medium come in, and the medium talked to whoever it was and came out and told us, that's not going to bother you anymore because whatever's here doesn't want you to leave, and it didn't.
And this, was this an exorcism some kind?
No, it was just somebody, because I wrote that piece on the Snow Hill Inn and worked with Nat Geo Television Network, I had their medium. So I just borrowed the medium. I happened to have a handy medium, so I brought the medium in, and it stopped.
Mindy Burgoyne, thank you very much for being with us today on Delmarva Today Writer's Edition. Your book is a fascinating book, Haunted Eastern Shore, and I certainly recommend it to anyone interested in both the history of the region, which is wonderful in itself, and the ghost stories that go with it. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back with our tale of terror, The Monkey's Paw, a chilling masterpiece of storytelling. You won't want to miss it.
Oh, yeah, that's a midnight special. That's a midnight special.
Thank you, Leadbelly. I'm Rich Warren, inviting you to join us for Alternative Radio Before There Were Alternatives, the Midnight Special, celebrating 60 years of folk music and farce, show tunes and satire, madness and escape. Sunday night at 10 on WSDL 90.7. From cutting-edge singer-songwriters to ancient ballads to classic comedy, folk music with a sense of humor, and so much more.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, the Writer's Edition. And now, The Monkey's Paw by W.W. Jacobs. Inside, in the parlor of the small English cottage, the blinds are drawn and the fire burns brightly. Mr. White and his son Herbert are at chess. Mrs. White is knitting placidly by the fire.
Listen to the wind, Father.
I'm listening, Mother. Check, Herbert. I don't think he'll come tonight.
Mate, Father.
Ha! That's the worst of living so far out. All that beastly, slushy, for God-forsaken place to live. This is the worst. Pathways, a bog, the roads, a torrent. I don't know what people are thinking about. Just because there are only two houses on our road, they think it doesn't matter.
Never mind, dear. Perhaps you'll win next time.
Mr. White looked up sharply, just in time to intercept a knowing glance between mother and son, and he hid a guilty grin behind his thin gray beard. Just then the front gate banged, and heavy footsteps were heard coming up the path toward the door. Mr. White rose with appropriate haste, opened the door to a tall, burly man, wet and bent from the wind and rain, and led him into the warmth of the parlor.
Sergeant Major Morris here. So pleased to meet you. Oh, what a beastly night it is.
Beady-eyed and red-faced, Sergeant Major Morris shook hands and, taking the proffered seat by the fire, watched contentedly while his host got out whiskey and tumblers and stood a small copper kettle on the fire. At the third glass, the Major's eyes got brighter, and he began to talk. The little family circle regarded with eager interest this visitor from distant parts as he squared his broad shoulders in the chair and spoke of strange scenes and intrepid deeds, of wars and plagues and strange peoples.
21 years of it. When he went away, he was a slip of a youth in the warehouse. Now look at him.
He looks to have done it well by it, I'd say.
I'd like to go to India myself. Just to look around, you know?
You're better off where you are.
Still, I'd like to see the old temples, the boxers, the jugglers. What was that you started telling me the other day about a monkey's paw or something?
Nothing. Leastwise, nothing worth hearing.
Monkey's paw?
Well, it's just a bit of what you might call magic, perhaps.
His three listeners leaned forward eagerly. The visitor absent-mindedly put his empty glass to his lips and then set it down again. His host filled it for him.
To look at, it's just an ordinary little paw, dried to a mummy.
The sergeant major took something out of his pocket and offered it. Mrs. White drew back with a grimace, but her son, taking it, examined it curiously.
And what is there special about it, Morris?
Mr. White took the monkey's paw from his son, examined it, and placed it on the table.
It had a spell put on it by an old faker, a very holy man. He wanted to show that fate ruled people's lives, and that those who interfered with it did so at their own peril. He put a spell on it so that three separate men could each have three wishes from it.
And did you take your three wishes?
The soldier's blotchy red face turned white, and he looked at Mr. White the way middle age is wont to regard impetuous youth.
And did you really have three wishes granted?
I did.
And has anyone else wished?
The first man had three wishes, yes. I don't know what the first two were, but the third was for death. That's how I got the paw.
If you've had your three wishes, it's no good to you now. Why do you keep it?
Fancy, I suppose.
If you could have another three wishes, would you take them?
I don't know. I don't know.
He took the paw and, dangling it between his front finger and thumb, suddenly threw it on the fire. Mr. White, with a slight cry, stooped down and snatched it off.
Better let it burn, Mr. White.
Well, if you don't want it, Morris, give it to me.
I won't. I threw it on the fire. If you keep it, don't blame me for what happens. Pitch it on the fire again, like a sensible man.
How do you do it, Morris? Tell us how you make a wish.
You're a fool, Mr. White, I tell you. Here, hold up your right hand and wish aloud. But I warn you of the consequences.
Sounds like the Arabian Nights, Father. All set for suffering now. Don't you think you might wish for four pairs of hands for me?
Mr. White brandished the white paw above his head, and all three burst into laughter as the sergeant major, with a look of alarm on his face, caught him by the arm.
If you must wish, wish for something sensible.
Mr. White dropped the paw back into his pocket and, placing chairs, motioned his friend to the table. In the business of supper, the talisman was partly forgotten. And afterward, the three sat listening in an enthralled fashion to a second installment of the soldier's adventures in India. Following coffee and brandy, the old soldier bid them good evening and disappeared toward the train in the wet, windy darkness.
If the tale about the monkey paw is no more truthful than those the sergeant major has been telling us about India, we shouldn't take it too seriously.
Did you give him anything for it, Father?
A little something. He didn't want it, but I made him take it. And he urged me again to throw it away.
Oh, not likely. We're going to be rich and famous and happy. Wish to be an emperor, Father. That's to begin with. Then you can't be henpecked.
I don't know. I don't know what to wish for. That's a fact. It seems to me I've got all I want.
If you retired your debt, you'd be happy, wouldn't you? Well, wish for 200 pounds, and that'll just about do it.
Mr. White, smiling shamefacedly at his own credulity, held up the paw as his son, with a solemn face, somewhat marred by a wink at his mother, sat down at the piano and struck a few impressive chords.
I wish for 200 pounds.
A fine crash on the piano followed his words, accompanied by a shuddering cry from Mr. White. The bone-white monkey's paw dropped to the floor.
It moved. It moved. As I wish, it twisted in my hands like a snake.
Well, I don't see any money, and I bet I never will.
It must just have been your imagination, Father.
Mr. White shook his head, then sat down by the fire. The two men finished their pipes. Outside, the wind was higher than ever, and Mr. White fidgeted nervously at the sound of the door banging upstairs. A silence unusual and depressing settled on all three, which lasted until the old couple rose to retire for the night.
I expect you'll find the cash tied up in a big bag in the middle of your bed and something horrible squatting up on top of the wardrobe watching you as you pocket your ill-gotten gains.
Herbert sat alone in the darkness now, gazing at the dying fire and seeing faces in it. The last face was so horrible and so simian that he gazed at it in amazement. It became so vivid that with a little uneasy laugh, he felt on the table for the glass containing a little water to throw over it. His hand grasped the monkey's paw, and with a little shiver, he wiped his hand on his coat and went to bed. In the brightness of the wintry sun next morning, as it streamed over the breakfast table, Herbert laughed at his fears. There was an air of prosaic wholesomeness about the room, and the dirty, shriveled little paw was pitched on the mantel with a carelessness which suggested no great belief in its virtues.
I suppose all soldiers are the same. The idea of our listening to such nonsense. How could wishes be granted in these days? And if they could, how could 200 pounds hurt you, Father?
Moore said the things happened so naturally that you might simply attribute it to coincidence.
I'm off to work, then. Just don't break into the money before I get back. I'm afraid it'll turn you into a mean, avaricious man, and we'll have to disown you.
Mrs. White laughed, and following Herbert to the door, watched him down the road, and returning to the breakfast table, was very happy at the expense of her husband's credulity. All of which did not prevent her from scurrying to the door at the postman's knock, nor prevent her from referring somewhat shortly to retired sergeant majors of strange habits when she found that the postman brought only a tailor's bill.
Herbert will have some more of his funny remarks, I expect, when he comes home.
I dare say, but for all that, the thing moved in my hand. I'll swear to.
You just thought it did. Now eat your lunch.
I say it did. There was no thought about it. What's the matter?
Mrs. White made no reply. She was watching the mysterious movements of a man outside who, peering in an undecided fashion at the house, appeared to be trying to make up his mind to enter. Remembering the 200 pounds, Mrs. White noticed that the stranger was well-dressed. Three times he paused at the gate, then walked on. The fourth time he stood with his hand on it, and then with a sudden resolution, flung it open and walked up the path. Mrs. White, at the same moment, placed her hands behind her and hurriedly unfastening the strings of her apron, put it beneath the cushion of a chair. She brought the stranger, who appeared ill at ease, into the room. He gazed at her furtively and listened in preoccupied fashion as Mrs. White apologized for the appearance of the room. She then waited as patiently as she could for him to broach his business, but he was at first strangely silent. Then,
I was asked to call. I'm from Maul and Megan's.
Is anything the matter? Has anything happened to Herbert? What is it?
There, Mother. Sit down. Don't jump to conclusions. You've not brought bad news, I'm sure, sir.
I'm sorry.
Is he hurt?
Badly hurt. But he is not in any pain.
Oh, thank God. Thank God for that.
She broke off suddenly as the sinister meaning of the assurance dawned on her, and she saw the awful confirmation of her fears in the other's averted face. She caught her breath, and turning to her slower-witted husband, laid her trembling hand on his. There was a long silence.
He was caught in the machinery.
Caught in the machinery? Gone? He was the only one left of us. It's so hard.
The firm wish me to convey their sincere sympathy to you in your great loss. I beg that you will understand that I am only their servant and merely obeying orders.
There was no reply. Mrs. White was suddenly an old woman. Her face was pale, her eyes staring, and her breath inaudible. On her husband's face was a look such as his friend, the sergeant major, might have carried into his first battle.
I want to say that Ma and Megan's disclaim all responsibility. They admit no liability at all, but in consideration of your son's services, they wish to present you with a certain sum as compensation.
Mr. White rose to his feet with a look of horror at his visitor. His dry lips shaped the words.
How much?
£200.
Unconscious of his wife's shriek, the old man smiled faintly, put out his hands like a sightless man, and dropped a senseless heap to the floor. In the huge new cemetery, some 2 miles distant, the old couple buried their dead son and returned to a house steeped in shadow and silence. It was all over so quickly that at first they could hardly realize it and remained in a state of expectation, as though something else was to happen, something else to lighten this load too heavy for old hearts to bear. But the days passed, and expectation gave way to resignation. Sometimes they hardly exchanged a word, for now they had nothing to talk about, and their days were long and empty. It was about a week after that the old man, waking suddenly in the night, stretched out his hand and found himself alone. The room was in darkness, and the sound of subdued weeping came from the window. He raised himself in bed and listened.
Come back, Mother. You're cold.
It's colder for my son.
The sound of her sobs died away on his ears. The bed was warm, and his eyes heavy with sleep. He dozed fitfully and then slept, until a sudden wild cry from his wife woke him with a start.
The paw! The monkey's paw!
Where is it? What's the matter?
I want it. You've not destroyed it.
It's in the parlor, on the mantel. Why?
I've only just thought of it. Why didn't I think of it before?
Think of what?
The other 2 wishes. We've only had the one.
Wasn't that enough?
No. We'll have one more. Go down and get it quickly, and wish our boy alive again.
Good God, you're mad.
Get it now and wish. Oh, my boy.
Come to bed. You don't know what you're saying.
We've only had the first wish granted. Why not the second?
A coincidence. Only a coincidence, Mother.
Go and get it now and wish.
He's been dead 10 days. Besides, I wouldn't tell you, but he was so mangled, I could only recognize him by his clothes. If he was too terrible for you to see then, how now?
Bring him back. Do you think I fear the child I nursed?
The old man went down in the darkness and felt his way to the parlor, and then to the mantelpiece. The paw was in its place, and a horrible fear that the unspoken wish might bring his mutilated son before him, before he could escape the room, seized him, and he caught his breath when he found that he had lost the direction to the door. His brow cold with sweat, he felt his way round the table and groped along the wall until he found himself in the small passage, the unwholesome thing in his hand. Even his wife's face seemed changed as he entered the room. It was white and expectant, and to his fears seemed to have an unnatural look about it. He was afraid of her.
Wish.
It's foolish. Wicked.
Wish.
I wish my son alive.
The monkey's paw fell to the floor, and the old man regarded it fearfully. Then he sank, trembling, into a chair, as the old woman with burning eyes walked to the window and raised the blind. The old man sat until he was chilled with the cold, glancing occasionally at the figure of his wife peering through the window. The candle end, which had burnt below the rim of the china candlestick, was throwing pulsating shadows on the ceiling and walls until, with a flicker larger than the rest, it expired. The old man, with an unspeakable sense of relief at the failure of the paw, crept back to his bed, and a minute or two afterward the old woman came to rest beside him. Neither spoke, but both lay silently listening to the ticking of the clock. A stair creaked, and a squeaky mouse scurried noisily through the wall. The wind made the old house groan. The darkness was oppressive, and after lying for some time, screwing up his courage, the old man took the box of matches and, striking one, went downstairs for a candle. At the foot of the stairs, the match went out, and he paused to strike another, and at the same time, a knock, so quiet and stealthy as to be scarcely audible, sounded on the front door. The matches fell from his hand. He stood motionless, his breath suspended until the knock was repeated. Then he turned and fled swiftly back to his room and closed the door behind him. A third knock sounded through the house.
What's that?
A rat. A rat. It passed me on the stairs.
A loud knock resounded now through the house.
It's Herbert. It's Herbert.
What are you going to do?
It's my boy. It's Herbert. I forgot it was 2 miles away. What are you holding me for? Let go. I have to open the door.
For God's sakes, don't let it in.
Are you afraid of your own son? Let me go. I'm coming, Herbert. I'm coming.
There was another knock, and another. The old woman ran from the room. Her husband followed to the landing and called after her. He heard the chain rattle back at the bottom of the bolt of the door was drawn slowly and stiffly from the socket. Then the old woman's voice strained and panting.
The top bolt. Come down. I can't reach it.
But the old man was on his hands and knees, groping madly on the floor in search of the paw. The paw. If he could only find it before the thing outside got in. A perfect fusillade of knocks reverberated through the house now, and he heard the scraping of a chair as his wife put it down in the passage against the door. He heard the creaking of the bolt as it slid slowly back. At the same moment, he found the monkey's paw, and frantically, the old man breathed his third and last wish. The knocking stopped, and there was only the wind buffeting the door and rattling the windows in the old house. I'd like to offer a very sincere thanks to all of our cast of characters, Don Rush as Mr. White, and the community players of Salisbury, Madeline Stiso as Mrs. White, Robert Forrester as Sergeant Major Morris, Matt Bogdan as Herbert, and Reed DeLeese as the man from Ma and Megan's. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to our Halloween edition of Delmarva Today, the writer's edition.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.